I have put the sources in the chat, so if anybody logging on now, they are there. And we're going to start actually in Perek Yud of Daniel. That's where we started last week. I think we spent the class last week talking a little bit about the beginning of this Perek, third year of Koresh, the year that Koresh rescinds the declaration of allowing the Jews. So we spoke last week about Koresh himself and the notion that Koresh enables the Jews of the temple, sort of signaling the end of the Babylonian exile. And some Jews return, not most by any stretch of the imagination. The majority stayed in Babel. Part of the dynamic of Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah is struggling with the question of the Jews who stayed behind. A small number of them come. And ultimately, 3 years later, there's a conflict in Israel, and Koresh rescinds the edict. We find Daniel in the beginning of the third year of Koresh, Melech Paras. After all the great anticipation, we find him mourning and fasting for 3 weeks or 21 days. And we spoke a little bit at the end of this year about the 21 days and its connection to the 3 weeks. More or less, I think that's where we got up to. Thumbs up if that's meets everybody else's recollection. Okay, great. So, and you can all hear me clearly. We're good. Okay, then let's move into the continuation of this parak. I think I mentioned before, from here until the end of the Sefer, chapters 10, 11, and 12 are essentially one major experience of prophecy for Daniel, but we're going to have to break it down because there's no way to practically deal with 3 chapters worth of material as a unit. So we're going to try to break it down as best we can. The 24th of the first month, 24th of Nisan, is the end of these 21 days. Chazal already point out the fact that this fast, whatever he was engaged in, whatever mourning he was engaged in, was so dramatic and so significant and so important to him that, much like Esther's fast in Chodesh Nisan, 3 days, which included the date of Pesach, this 21 days in the month of Nisan ends on the 24th of the month, which of course meant it to include Pesach. Topic, I'm not going to address it here because it's going to take us off topic, but you should be aware of the phenomenon that virtually of the prophecies of the Second Temple period from Daniel, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, a little bit in Ezra, all of the major prophecies of that whole period of time all take place on the 24th of the month. There's a few other prophecies that other day, the 24th of the month was a significant day for this moment. Medan writes a little bit in the footnote in his Sefer about the fact that that might be connected to the kind of week before Rosh Chodesh preparation. But just an FYI. וביום 24 לחודש הראשון, ואני הייתי על יד הנהר הגדול, הוא החידקו. Daniel is sitting there by the waters of the Chideko, and ועשת עיני ואראה, והנה איש אחד לבוש בדים. And he lifts up his eyes, and he sees a man clothed in linen. In this case, we know that this man is going to be a malach. And Daniel has had several prophecies and communications with angels and malachim in the past, and he'll continue in the future for the rest of the book. But this, he lifts up his eyes, and at this stage, he sees an individual. Motnav chagurim beketem ubaz, loins were girded with fine gold. Ugviato ketarshish, his body was like tarshish, which is a kind of a stone or ufanav kemare barak. His face shone like lightning. Ve'enav kilapideish. His eyes like fires. Watav umargulatav ki nechoshet kalal. And his arms and his feet like the color of nechoshet. Ve'kol dvarav kekolamon. And his voice made you tremble like the voice of the multitude. So clearly this was not an ordinary person. This was a vision that we'll see. The more he saw, the more frightening this vision became. And that is part of the experience of prophecy, is that it's extraordinarily frightening. And he lifts up his eyes initially and he sees a man, but suddenly he realizes that this man is not an ordinary man, but in fact, a malach. And the reference to Eish is not surprising. Ra'iti ani Daniel levadia tamareh. I, Daniel, alone saw this vision. V'ha'anashim asher ayu imi lo ra'u tamareh. But the people who were with me, the men who were with me, they couldn't see the vision. So they didn't see what I saw of this man described above in this frightening description. The people who were with me, they didn't see it at all. But aval charada gdola nafla alehem. But they felt the trembling. They felt the experience. They felt the awe. They felt the fear. Vayivruchu behechaveh. And in so doing, they fled and they went to hide themselves because the feeling was so intense and so frightening. But I stood my ground. Ani nishayti levadi. And I saw this great vision, but it literally drained me of strength. My face, complexion disappeared, and my splendor was turned from mashkid. I had no strength. I collapsed. Ve'eshmat kol dvarav. And then I heard his voice. Ukeshomi et kol dvarav. When I heard his voice, eit nirdam al panai ufanai arza. I literally fell into a trance. I fell into a deep sleep. I went my face to the ground. I collapsed. Vine yad nagabi, a hand touched me. Vatnieni al birkai vekapot yaday, and it stood me up, and it stood me on my knees and upon the palms of my hands. Vayomer elai Daniel ish chamudot, and said to me, Daniel, you greatly beloved man, haven bedvarim asher anochi daver elacha. Vamod al omdecha. No, understand the words I speak to you and stand right upright. Yata shulachti elecha, for I have now been sent to speak to you. Ubedabroimi et hadavar hazeh amadati ma'id. When he spoke these words to me, I stood trembling. And I'm going to stop here because the rest of this parak will deal with the substance of his nevuah, which we'll get to either the rest of the shiur today or beginning of next week. But I want to first focus on this opening description of the prophetic experience. Rambam builds much of his analysis of the experience of prophecy, the fact that it physically drains you, that it's a physically difficult experience, and etc. He builds from this moment. And there's a great emphasis in these psukim on the dread and the fear and the trembling and the frightening image of what this, just before the words even come, just the experience of seeing this mar'eh, that frightened the people with him, anashim asher ayu imi, who didn't even see the vision, but they could feel the trembling and they could feel the fright, afal charada gdola nafla alehem, and they ran. So I want to start with a simple question, which is, who are these people who are with Daniel? It's the first time we're hearing of them. They're not named. It could be just a general group of people that he was kind of holding court and having a conversation with others on the or edge of the river. And suddenly he sees his vision and everybody else who was there, ordinary people that just kind of ran. That's possible. On the other hand, usually people who are with the Navi, in this case, are usually people of some kind of significance and stature. And Chazal did not ignore this phenomenon. So what you have, actually, while I'm looking at the sources, let me for one last time, for those who have joined us since, post the link to the source page here. So if you want it, download it. I'm going to display it on the screen. But Rashi immediately picks up from the this point, and it's a reference to the Gemara in Megillah, that the Nashim Asher Hayuimi, the people who were with him, says Rashi, Amru Rabotenu Heim Chagai Zechariah Malachi. They are the three prophets, Chagai Zechariah and Malachi. Who are Chagai Zechariah and Malachi? They are the three prophets in Tanakh that accompany the story of the rebuilding of the Second Temple and the beginning of Shivat Zion and Bayit Sheni. The stories of Chagai Zechariah and Malachi, contemporary to the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, they're mentioned in Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah. Chagai and Malachi are more or less Chagai and Zechariah more or less contemporaries, Malachi a little bit later, but in all cases they are beginning of Bayit Sheni. Maininu Anashim. Again, this is the Gemara Megillah that Rashi is quoting. Who are these people who are with him? Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah beitem Rabbi Chaba. Ze Chagai Zechariah Malachi. These are the prophets of Bayit Sheni, Chagai Zechariah Malachi. And here the Gemara goes on to explain why are they called Anashim and why is Daniel the subject of the text. So the Gemara says the following: Inhu Adifa Minei V'iyu Adif Minayo. In some capacity, in some ways, these Anashim, usually it's picking up on a kind of a nuance that typically the Torah will refer to people of stature as Anashim. Anashim Kriyei Moed by the Nesiim, people of stature. So they are people of stature. They're not just ordinary people standing around, happen to be there for a reason. On the other hand, Inu Adifim, Inhu Adifi Mine, they were greater than him in some capacity. V'iyu Adif Minayu, in some other capacity, he had a benefit or advantage over them. Inhu Adifi Mine, they had an advantage over him. The Inhu Nevi'i V'iyu Lav Navi. Chagai Zechariah Malachi are Nevi'im. They're in the books of Nevi'im. They're considered Nevi'im. Daniel, and we spoke about this very early in the beginning of our study of Daniel, it's a huge controversy as to whether Daniel had the status of a Navi or a vision Jose. In other words, like Yosef, who has dreams and interprets them, Daniel has visions or dreams and he interprets them. Does that make him a Navi? His book is in the book of Ketuvim. It's a major source of conversation, whether or not he's a Navi in the list of Nevi'im, or just a visionary in some way in terms of the ability to communicate with God, let's say on the level of Ruach HaKodesh, but not Nevuah, one level down, says the Rambam. So in this Gemara, that's the position, that they are Nevi'im and he is not. Iu Adif Minayu, but he, Daniel, was greater than they were at that moment. The Ihu Chazav V'inu L'Chazav, for he was able to see the vision of this Malach, and they were not. They only saw the experience, but they could not feel. They only felt the experience, but they could not see what Daniel saw. Says the Gemara v'chim yachad lochazu, if they didn't see, my time ibeitu, why were they so frightened? Says the Gemara, al afagav de inu lochazu, even though they didn't see, mazalayu chazu, their mazal, their angel, their guardian angel, their constellation, if you will, saw. So I'm not sure what to do with that statement, and I'll share with you what I think it means. And I think it has a very important ramification for us. But let's start with the question of who Chagai Zechariah Malachi are. I mean, if we're talking about Chagai Zechariah Malachi, we're talking about Nevi'im. Why is Daniel seeing that which the Nevi'im can't see? That's an odd phenomenon altogether. Where is Daniel and where is Chagai Zechariah Malachi here? So let's first deal with the obvious. Who does the Gemara rule out as the identity of these Anashim? Who's not being mentioned in this conversation? Who might we have thought would be the Anashim who are with Daniel, and the Gemara says it's not the case?
His friends?
Right.
Well, Chizkiyahu, no, you mean Yechezkel.
Yechezkel, yeah.
Yechezkel's Yeah, Cheskel is probably not part of this conversation. There's no real explicit reference. And we had several dialogues between Daniel and Yecheskel and the Medrash. I'm not sure what to do with Yecheskel in that regard for now. But certainly the logical initial reference would be, why would we not say it's Daniel's three friends from the beginning of the Sefer Hananya, Mishael, Azariah? And the answer to that question, I think, is the same answer to the second question, which is, how is it possible that Haggai's Chayachi, who are Nevi'im, couldn't see what Daniel could see? So the answer to both these questions is built into the chronology of the moment. Meaning, where is Daniel in his life at this point in time? Geographically, but conceptually, right? Where is he? Daniel is sitting in, sorry, I'm just going to do something to make my internet a little bit. Can everybody hear and see me? That's my, I just got to notice my internet. Daniel is at the end of his life. Daniel is an old man. Daniel, if he was a young man when he came into the story, or a young boy, I should say, Daniel at this point is towards the end of his life. We're talking about from Galut Bavel, from Galut Yehoyachin, which is from the very beginning, to the story of Koresh. And this is the very last vision that Daniel see, which is the third year of Koresh, which means that we're at least 50, probably even maybe even 60 or 70 years later. Daniel is certainly an old man. The impression, and here it's not stated, but the impression one gets from the description of the fact that Daniel, that these Hanashim Ashir Hayu Imi, the people who are with him, go running away and hiding because they can't see the experience, but they forget the sense that they are much younger than Daniel. Chagai Zechariah Malachi, sorry, Hanani Mishael Azariah would have been contemporaries to Malachi, to Daniel. And so the Gemara says, we're not talking about them. We don't know what happened to them. There's no reference to it at all in the text. We don't know what happened to them. But the likelihood that if it was the same three people as the beginning of the book, it would have told us. His friends or his colleagues or his partners or his whatever their status is. They're out of the picture. They've been out of the picture since the story of the Kivshan Ha'esh. What we have here, on the other hand, is Anashim, not named, but who are not experienced enough in the world of prophetic moments to be able to process this experience. And so the likelihood is that they're much younger. And if that's true, that also explains why Chazal link it to Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, because what you'll have is the roots of where Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi start from as Nevi'im. Who's their mentor? Who's their teacher? Who's their guide? We don't know anything about them. And their story begins at the beginning of Sefer Ezra. But it's possible that they are a younger version here of Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, who are just learning, learning from the mentor, learning from Daniel. And in that regard, it would also explain why Daniel can see that which they can only feel. You know, prophecy is an interesting moment. There's a vision to prophecy, but there's also an experience that you can kind of sense, a dread of you feel the awe and the trembling of the moment. By Maamar HaSinai, you have this description at length of the extent to which Maamar HaSinai you have this dread and fear that overwhelms the camp. They trembled, they feared the fire, right? Everything that the Nashim here are experiencing, we experienced at Maamar HaSinai. The difference was that, of course, at Maamar HaSinai, we merited to see something, whereas here they did not. But if, another analogy that's kind of opposite end of the spectrum is the donkeys. Malach stood in the middle of the road, and Bilam couldn't see the donkey, the malach, built any experience or fear or feel the presence of the malach. The donkey, on the other hand, clearly the Aton did not see the malach, but the Aton was frightened, could sense it, and his senses were frightened. And that's what I think you're getting in this Anashim Asher, you and me, Lora Utamare. They didn't see it, but they could sense the awe, the dread, the fear, something that was overwhelming, and therefore they did what was only natural. They ran. They were yet ready for the prophetic experience. Daniel, on the other hand, was much older, much more experienced. He stands his ground, and Bani Nisharti Levadi, right? He stands his ground, and he sees the Mareh Havdolah, the experience, kind of the language here, reminiscent of the story of Moshe by the Sneh. I'll turn to see this great Mareh, the fire that does not consume. Here you have Daniel standing his ground, but it drains him of his strength. And that the Rambam builds as sort of the experience of prophecy being physically one that drains one's strength, the only prophet for whom that was not the case. They could stand and they could see prophecy awake and it didn't drain them of their physical strength, says the Rambam, was, of course, the Nevuah of Moshe, which is described in the Torah as Peh. God spoke to Moshe face to face like one would speak, panim o panim, like one would speak with one's friends. But every other Navi, it's an overwhelming experience. And that's exactly what is described here. So by
maybe they saw what was happening. Maybe they saw what was happening to Daniel, and that's what scared them and made them run away.
Maybe it says that they were frightened by the Mareh Anashim. It's possible that they were frightened by the experience. The simple reading of it is that they felt something. Daniel felt something, but he also saw something. Remember, this starts by describing the Ish Lavush Abadim that Daniel saw. So he saw this man, he saw this experience, this lapideish, this man who looked like fire. And they felt the trembling of the moment. There are other moments when we've sensed the dread and fear of the experience without seeing it in prophecy. I don't want to belabor too much, but that's certainly the possibility. And Daniel sees it. And the moment he hears the voice of prophecy itself, Peshmat Kol Dvarav, and the moment he hears that voice, Ukashomiyat Kol Dvarav, because prophets experience prophecy in a state of trance. And so he kind of collapses, like a tardema, right? The word nirdam comes from the same root as the word tardema. Tardema is used, interesting root, by Abraham when he falls into a trance. The vision of the Brit Ben Abtarim. And you have the same moment, you have the same experience where he has this prophetic vision and it throws him into a trance. And in that trance, he has that that kind of prophecy. Combined terror, darkness, and fear that overwhelmed him. This is even before the Nevuah starts. This is the experience of the presence of the Shekhinah, says that this is by Abraham. So you have a similar experience here. Tardim nafla alav. I heard once from Rav Meidan, and again, this is a take it or leave it observation, just interesting, that it might explain the odd medrash of Amar HaSinai. You know, there's the famous medrash that's quoted by Magen Avraham that the reason we stay up all night learning Shavuos night is a tikkun lo shavuot in preparation for Matan Torah. It's because the medrash says that they were all sleeping and they at the time of Matan Torah, right? God came to them, they were sleeping in their beds. So that's the Magen Avraham quotes this Ash, She Yisrael Ayu Yeshenim Kol HaLaila. They were sleeping and HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to wake them up. And therefore, we stay up on that learning. So I heard from Rabbi Nan, the simple reading of this medrash is plausible, impossible. Right? The notion that they come all the way this after Yitzhak Mitzrayim, 49 days, and they're sitting at Mount Sinai, and they're sitting at the foot of the mountain, and they all went to sleep, and they didn't set alarm clocks. It doesn't fit. Whereas if you perceive it from the perspective of the fear and the dread and the trembling that they all underwent through that preparation for that revelation, as described by Avram, as described by the donkey of Bilam, as described here in Daniel, and v'aninayti nirdam, right? What's the result of the communication when the actual revelation comes? Next step is to literally the person, especially if they're not completely prepared for it, collapses, much as Abraham fell into a tardema. And well, maybe that's the experience that Am Yisrael felt at the moment of Mamre HaSinai. That after all the fear and the trembling and the voice starts, and people literally just fell into this trance, much as Daniel does. And that might be the explanation, Medrash, for the notion of Unir Dam Kolalailo. They were sleeping that night. She saw Yeshinim Kolalai. Be that as it may, that's an observation. Take it or leave it. I think it's a fascinating insight into how Chazal kind of weave Midrashim into this moment. Okay, questions on the introduction, and then we're moving on to the second half of the parak. Okay. Ve'yomer Eli. And now the Malach comes and he stood me up and he said, I've come to speak to you. This is your moment. Stand on your feet. I'm going to communicate. Ve'yomer Eli. Al tira. Don't be afraid. Iminayom harishon shenatati libcha lavin ulit anot lifnei alokecha. Remember that Daniel is fasting for 21 days because something has frightened him, something has jolted him, something has, addition to the tardema that he's fell into here, he's been davening and fasting and praying for 21 days, something is bothering him. So the Malach comes to him and he says, "Min ha'yom ha'rishon shenatata et libcha lahavin litanot lifnei Elokecha." In the very beginning of your tefillah, the very beginning of those 21 days when you were engaged in this kind of attempt to understand and to fast and to self-afflict, nishmu dvarecha, your tefillot were heard. V'ani bati bidvarecha, I have come to answer you. I have come to give you an answer because of your words. V'sar malchut paras omed l'negdi 21 yom. But the prince of the Tsar, of the kingdom of Persia, has challenged me, stood against me for 21 days. So before we even move into the next part of the pasuk, the two things to note in this phrase. First of all, you're all familiar with the fact that Chazal had this description, Rashi quotes it throughout Sefer Bereishit, that every nation in the world has a ministering angel responsible for it. You've heard that before, right? That comes from here. It comes from more than anywhere else. You see, Daniel has this reference to the Tsar of every kingdom. And these malachim who are talking to Daniel, they're struggling. The events of world powers struggling with each other depicted in the heavens by the ministering angels fighting with each other. It's a fascinating perspective. V'sar malchut paras omed l'negdi 21 yom. It took me 21 days to get to Kavyachol, and Daniel's fasting for 21 days because I've been struggling with the kingdom of Persia. V'nei Michael achad asarim arishonim ba'al azreini. And one of the chief malachim, princes, came to help me. His name is Michael. How many, we know the names of malachim. How many names of malachim? How many malachim can we name? There's Michael, there's Gabriel, there's Raphael, there's Riel. Right? We mentioned them in Ne'ilah and in Kriyat Shema Le'itah. In Tanakh, there are only two by name, and they're both in Sefer Daniel, Michael, and Gabriel. We talked to Gabriel before. Actually, I'm just there's a little bit of background noise. I'm gonna put everybody on mute, but feel free to unmute. I'm just to communicate, just the background noise. So there's a the angels are mentioned by name. The name Michael, Achad Basamim Rishonim, Ba'ala Azrainis came to assist me. And I remained there together, struggling with the kingdom, with the prince of Persia. And how I come to help you understand what shall befall your people, is that famous phrase, Ba'acharit Hayamim, which historically, traditionally has been translated as in the end of days. We, alternative translation of this phrase based on our study of the earlier chapters in Daniel, that is not necessarily about the end of days, but about some future time. We'll come back to that, B'zvat Hashem, over the next few chapters. For there is yet a vision for the future days. When he spoke these words to me, I had my face to the ground. I was dumbfounded. I couldn't speak. And this likeness of a human being, a description of the Malachim, came and touched my lips. And I could open my mouth and I could speak. And I said to the one standing before me, Adoni, my master, in my vision, my bone pains that came upon me, I had no strength left, I collapsed. How is it possible that my servant can speak, that this servant of my Lord can talk to me, right? How can I speak with you? I have no strength, I have no breath. So this Malach came, touched me again, and gave me strength. Al tida ish chamudo. Do not be afraid, O beloved man. Shalom lach. It will be good. You will have peace. Which is much like the conversation, several conversations in Tanakh in which there's a vision of a conversation with a malach that is so dreadful and so frightening that the individual who has that experience thinks they're going to die. For example, Manoach. Father of Shimshon, Anesh Manoach, in Sefer Shoftim, when Manoach, Anesh Manoach, the vision of the conversation with the Malach who says she's going to have a child and what she should do with the child and become a Nazir, etc. And then the man, the Manoach, the same vision, when the Malach is finished, was at the Shemayim in fire, Manoach says to his wife, we're going to die. She was smart enough to realize that if the vision was so dreadful that it was going to cause them to die, then there would have been no point in having the vision in the first place. So that's what she says to him. She says, and what would have been the purpose of all of this? Gidon, exactly the same kind of reaction. He sees a Malach who communicates with him about about his mission, and Malach goes up to Shemayim, and he feels that he's going, and he's afraid. Right, there is this notion that these experiences were frightening. So the Malach says to Daniel, "Ish chamudot, shalom lach. Don't be afraid. It will be peace to you. Chazak, be strong." Ukedabroimi chazakti. As he spoke to me, I gained strength. V'omra idabrani ki chazaktani, and I said, "Okay, my Lord, now the strength to listen." Yomer. Said to me, do you know why I have come to you? So now we've reached the point. We've reached the conclusion. We reached the final message. Okay, why am I here? What's it all about? I will now go back and fight and struggle with the prince of Persia. Vani yotze, vihine sar yavan ba. And as I go, behold, the prince of Greece shall come in its place. So what's the message? In short, in one sentence, what's the message?
The Paras is gone. It's going to be gone soon, and Greece is next.
You can't win.
Paras has failed, and yeah. Greece is on its way. Now, that's a very strange message to convey in the third year of Cyrus. Remember, we're talking about a dynasty of Persian kings that is just at the beginning. We are, and we'll get to the chronology next week, but we are decades, if not centuries, away from Alexander the Great. But we are looking at, in the world of the Malachim, things get prepared, historical events get prepared well in advance. So he said to him, I've been struggling with the king of with the prince of Persia. And he's going. And Greece shall come. All hopes had been pinned on Koresh's declaration and on the Persians allowing the Jews to return to the land of Israel and build the temple. Here's 3 years later, after Koresh has rescinded that decree, and he's crying and he's mourning and he's fasting and he's trying to understand what happened, what went wrong, where are we at, why is this happening? And a Malach comes to him and he says, Persia is going to fall, just as Babel fell to Persia. And now Persia, it may take a few years, Persia is going to fall. And in the ministering angel's world, he's already identified Va'ani Yotze Vihine Sar Yavanba. On the horizon, I can already see the next empire you're going to have to contend with, and that's Greece. And why Greece is the focus here, we'll see in the next parak in much more detail, chapter 11 and 12. But I would argue that really the whole point of this whole book of Daniel is to understand the foundation of the story of Greece. It's not about Babel and it's not about Persia. It's about Yavan. That's where he's going. And that's where his final prophecy will take us. I'm going to tell you that which is inscribed in the writing of truth. There is no one that stands against me. Or with me. Ki im Michael Sechem. Except for Michael, your prince. But some of the was actually speaking to the Tsar But why he says Michael Sechem, Michael is the Tsar of Israel, maybe. But there is none that stands with me in these things. Ki im Michael Sechem. So what does it say? So we have to realize that now this is a long prophecy. So we're going to read two psukim in the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph. Vani bishnat achat ledaryavash hamadi omdi lemachazik lemozlo. I, from the very first year of Daryavash hamadi, I stood up to be a supporter and a stronghold to him. Whether that's a reference to Michael, most likely, in the previous pasuk, right? Avagil lechatoshum echadamet, ein echad mitchazek mi'aleila ki Michael Sarchem. The only one who stands with me is Michael Sarchem, and from the first year of the Havish, I stood to support him. Etayemet agidlach. Here we come to what is, again, essentially going to be the subject of our study for the next two classes, this week and next week, this pasuk. Hine od shloshavim omdim leparas. There will yet be three kings of Persia. Vaharivii yashir osher gadol miko. And the fourth shall be richer, far richer than all of them that came before. ukechazkato, and in his strength, beoshro, to his riches, ya'ir hakol et malchut yan. He will stir up all against the realm of Greece. V'amad melech gibor, and then a mighty king shall come from Greece. U'memshal u'memshal rav, with great ruling and power. V'asak kirtzono, dominion as he pleases. And the rest of this parak is about Alexander the Great and his aftermath. I'm going to leave the rest of the parak for now because we're still in Persia. We need to understand this pasuk. Pasuk bet. If it was a pasuk, I can say for Neil to memorize, this would be it. Ata emet agid lach, hineh od shlosha malachim omdim leparas. It's going to be three more kings of Persia. V'arevi'i, but the fourth, yashir osher gadol mikol, he will be wealthier than all of them. O b'oshro ya'ir hakol t'machut yavan. And in his wealth, he will awaken the kingdom of Greece. So, of course, if we have such a verse that gives us a clue into the future events of history, we need to understand from a hindsight perspective on history, who was this vision referring? That is the centerpiece of the argument in the Rishonim, in Chazal, in Midrashim, in historical information, much of the epicenter around the storming debate about the chronology of Persia is built around this pasuk. So that's where we're going to start our discussion. Who is these four kings about whom it says that the three more kings of Persia and the fourth will awaken Greece? Who and what is he talking about? So Rashi says, based on the Medrash, and here there's almost unanimity amongst the Rishonim, most likely because they had limited access to external historical data, but universal consensus almost amongst the Mefarshim that who are the almost, I said, because we'll see there is a machloket. Who is this? Who are these four kings? Says Rashi. Rabbateinu amru besedo alam. There's that besedo alam which the Rishonim relied on for their understanding of the chronology of Tanakh. Who are these four kings? Ze Koresh v'Achashverosh v'Daryavesh shebana bayit. Koresh, Achashverosh, and Daryavesh, which are the three kings of Persia that we have encountered and continue to encounter in our study of Tanakh. Koresh, the declaration of Koresh, Achashverosh in the story of Purim, Daryavesh, who allows to the final building of the temple after that process was rescinded. But that's only three. Who's the fourth? So Rashi says, Ma tamad lamar revi'iyu. Revi'i lemadai. Four, if you start counting one before Koresh, which makes sense in the parak. Because if you remember what it says, it starts with a reference to the fact that I came and looked at this. I've been standing here participating in this story since the beginning of the predecessor to Koresh, namely Daryavesh Hamadi. And from that point forward, od shlosha melachim. So the fourth is Daryavesh, and the four kings in total are Daryavesh Hamadi, the Median king, Daryavesh, as a predecessor to Koresh, Koresh, Achashverosh, and then Daryavesh, Arsi. Those are the four kings, and more or less, that's traditional chronology. Now, we're going to challenge the traditional chronology in a minute for various reasons, but understand that that's the classic perspective on the chronology of Tanakh. That the four kings that we're talking about are, in fact, Bashamadi, Koresh, Achashverosh, and Daryavesh HaParsi. The reference Rashi makes to Seder Olam, I shared with you in Source 7, This is the Medrash itself. Who are the three kings? Zekoresh, Achashverosh, V'Daryavish, Shabana Abayit. And why does it say four? Because we're starting from four from Daryavish HaMadi, four from the end of Bavo. The four kings from the end of Bavo, Daryavish HaMadi, Koresh, Achashverosh, and Daryavish. More or less, that's how it's perceived. Ibn Ezra similarly makes the following comment. We're going to see some equivocation in the Ibn Ezra, but for now, Amar Gaon ki Malchei Madayu Paras Him Dalid, the interpretation of the Gaonim was that the Persian kings numbered four in total. The Eluhem, Dayavesh HaMadi, Koresh HaDayavesh HaMadi, V'Koresh HaParsi, Gam Achashverosh, V'Dayavesh HaParsi. Four kings, Dayavesh HaMadi, Cyrus, Achashverosh, and Darius the Persian. Shehargo Alexandros, who was killed by Alexander the Great. Because remember, the Nevuah links the moment of the fall of this fourth king to the beginning of Malchut Yavan. Alexander the Great kills Darius of Persia. So that's exactly what's described here. That says the Ibn Upireshine od shloshan malachim. The fact that he says there's another three kings, meaning via pirusha revi'i shu dayavish ha-parsi revi'i ledavish ledayavish ha-madi. Okay. So more or less that's the consensus around the traditional chronology of Tanakh, namely that you have that the Persian Empire described here is summarized in the kingdoms or the reigns of these four kings. Dayavish meets Alexander the Great on the battlefield, dies in battle, and Alexander the Great takes over. That happens to be historically accurate. Dayavish is the final king of Persia. The only difference is that whereas Chazal only have one Dayavish in this regard, history has three, and so you have Darius the Third, who falls to Alexander the Great. We'll talk about that probably next week. I just want to kind of pull the foundation sources together today, and then we'll look at where it goes. The basis for this interpretation is essentially the reading of the chapter in Sefer Ezra that we looked at last week, because there, and I put the psukim here, I kind of gave you snapshots of them, but if you look at the sequence of the chapter, in chapter 4 of Ezra, that's where the local indigenous population, not indigenous population, the local population comes, and the Tzarei Yehudah Binyamin, the adversaries of Judah, and they ask Zubavel, they want to build a temple together in partnership, and Zubavel says no, and then they go out and they hire counselors or adversaries to frustrate their purpose, frustrate their goal, and the result is that Koresh rescinds the decree to allow the building of the temple. That frustration is Ko Yimei Koresh Melech Paras, V'ad Machut Daryavish Melech Paras, all the days of Koresh until the days of Daryavish. Uve Malchut Achashverosh bitchilat Malchuto katvu sitna Yeshve Yehuda v'Yishalayim. In the kingdom of Achashverosh, in the beginning of his reign, there was some kind of accusation written against the Jews. Ubimei Artachshasto katav, and in the days of Artachshasto, these individuals wrote a letter in Aramaic saying to rescind, asking to rescind the temple construction. And so the temple sat constructed until Shnatarten L'machut Dayavish, until the second year of Dayavish. So understanding the structure of this parak is critical to understanding how Chazal, how the Tanakh looked at history. Who are these kings? Koresh, Dayavish, Achashverosh, Artachshasta. Suddenly there's another king there. That's not part of our list. Our list had Koresh, Dayavish HaMadi is out of the picture because he's not Persian. Koresh, Achashverosh, and Dayavish. Suddenly we have Koresh and Dayavish, Achashverosh, Artachshasta, and then back to Achashverosh. And so back to Dayavish. So who is this Atach Shasta? So Rashi says on the one hand, maybe he's a reference to Koresh. On the other hand, he could be a reference to Dayavish. Meaning that Atach Shasta, and this is based on the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah, Atach Shasta, Chazal understood, not as the name of a king, but rather as the name of a kingdom. Much like Paro, it's right. Atach Shasta, says the Gemara, was the name of the Malchus, name of the kingdom. Now, historically, we know that that's inaccurate, because we know that there were Persian kings. We're going to get to the list of the Persian kings B'Rishat Hashem next week. You have Xerxes, and you have Artaxerxes, or Artaxasta, and you have Darius first and Darius the second, and many different kings, the kingdom. The chronology here is a major challenge. But what the Gemara is essentially trying to understand is the sequence of the kings in this text. You have Koresh, then you have Dayavish, then you have Achashverosh, then you have Artaxasta. So if Artaxasta is Dayavish, and the letter written to Artaxasta is the letter written here till, right, this is a long chapter that deals with one long letter asking the king to rescind the temple, and he finds the original letter of Cyrus. He doesn't find the second letter of Cyrus, and so he allows the building of the temple to begin again. Then it makes sense that he's a reference to Dayavish, says Rashi, and then the kings are in order. Koresh, Achashverosh, Artaxasta / Dayavish. And the sequence of Persia of kings is as we have identified. I'm going to I'm going to take a stop here for a second and just interject from a different context that the reason why this sequence is so important to us, besides the historical accuracy of it and our attempt to understand Sefer Daniel, is the major impact this has on our understanding of another text of Tanakh, namely, and the impact this has on another text of Tanakh is important. Which text am I referring to?
Esther.
Wherever the epicenter around the identification of Achashverosh in the book of Esther is critical. Everything around the historical time period of Persia is going to take us into the realm of what does that mean for Megillat Esther? Well, what does this mean for Megillat Esther? This is the traditional This is the more commonly identified reading of the chronology of the kings of Persia. What does it mean? What does it entail for an understanding of the story of Purim? Let's put it in perspective. Koresh is the declaration to return to the land of Israel. First year, third year rescinds that declaration. Then Achashverosh comes along. There's a terrible Ktav Sitna, there's a decree of some kind of accusation against inhabitants of Judah and Yerushalayim. And then in the days of Artaxasta, we have this letter. What? Achashverosh is the story of Purim. And then Dayavish, who allows the Jews to rebuild the temple. So how do you understand the story of Purim in that regard? Who is Achashverosh and what role does he play? Or I should ask the question differently. Who is Dayavish and what role does he play? You understand my question? It's a critical question. If I sequence the kings of Persia this way and I put Achashverosh in between Cyrus and Darius, what does that mean for the story of the Megillah?
Esther's son.
That is the Medrash that says that the Yavish is the son of Achashverosh and Esther. Now, whether that is historically provable or defensible, as the position is historically accurate, that we'll talk about. That is the Medrash, again, based on looking at the text here. If Achashverosh is sandwiched between Koresh and Dayavish, these are the kings of Persia, then the reason that Dayavish is the son of Achashverosh and Esther. If he's the son of Achashverosh and Esther, then that would explain a little bit as to Dayavish's benevolence to the Jewish people and allowing the Jews to return to build the temple, right? Dayavish is a nice Jewish boy sitting on the throne of Persia, a whole different way of reading history. It also explains a little bit of the story of Achashverosh and Mordechai and Esther and the Jews in Persia, meaning that they are caught in the moment of the rescinding of the declaration of Koresh, the backlash against the Jews, the anti-Semitism of Haman, and etc. And essentially, I end up explaining the story of Purim around the identification of Achashverosh as the king in between Koresh and Dayavish. That is that's what I would say, traditional interpretation. I don't know, you can raise your hand if you want, but I'm sure you've all heard that line of thinking and reasoning and explanation of the story of Purim, that Achashverosh, the Jews are sitting in exile, they're waiting for the redemption to come, they're waiting for the temple to be rebuilt, and the only question, theological question you can really ask is why the Jews in Shushan still there. Why didn't they go back under Cyrus's initial formation? Okay, there were lots of Jews who did not go back under Cyrus's initial proclamation. Nonetheless, that's about the extent of it. And the rest of the story we have to figure out in context. The problem with this interpretation, and I want to make this very clear, we're going to identify the problem in the remaining 2 minutes of today's class. We're going to try to offer a solution next week. But the problem is on two levels. Level number one is parshanut, pure exegesis, pure text. Does it work with the context of all of the references that we have in Tanakh? And problem number two is historical. Does it work with the plethora of historical data that we have at our hands and our fingertips today that, and we've had for a long time, but that we didn't have at the time of Chazal, perhaps, and certainly not at the time of Shona? And the answer to that is really no. Just to put in perspective, I'm going to come back to all these sources in Greek, but I just want to put in perspective. This is a reference, that same text, Seder Olam Rabbah, which is a fundamentally important text in terms of understanding how Chazal saw Tanakh. First of all, we'll deal with the question, who Koresh, who Dayavish, who Tarshasta, how does Chazal see these kings? But here's the reference I want to talk about in terms of chronology. Ko Shnei Malchei Madayu Paras Chamishim Ushtayim. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Machut Paras, Bifnei Abayit, 34 Shana. Says the Medrash, entire history of Persia is 52 years in length. All the kings of Persia made together, says the Medrash, is 52 years. And of those 52 years, 34 of them are after the temple was built. That is historically based on the assumption that I only have three kings of Persia, and one of them is Darius, who is also Artaxerxes. Sefer Nehemiah, we have 36 years of Artaxerxes listed in that context. So clearly he had to have existed for 36 years, or 34 of them after the temple was built, and that leaves for only 54 years. Now, the problem is that we know historically that there were more than four Persian kings. And to put all of these, for example, and even Rashi, who had some historical data from sources like Yosef ben Gurion, or Yosifun, says that there was a child to Koresh who reigned Koresh, and his name was Bambisa or Cambyses or Cambuzi, Rashi says in the Gemara, and he must be Achashverosh, right? So Rashi. Again, because Rashi had whatever small pieces of historical data Rashi had at his fingertips, tried to kind of squeeze into the picture, but it doesn't work, because when you start to look at the historical reference points of the kings of Persia, we have 10 kings of Persia. There's a couple of additional ones that are much smaller, but these are the Achaemenid Empire starts with Cyrus the Great, Cambyses, Darius, Xerxes, Darius the Second, Artaxerxes the Second, Artaxerxes the Third, Artaxerxes the Fourth, Darius the Third. Darius the Third, by the way, falls to Alexander the Great. This is to put all of this into 54 years of history doesn't work. And so Chazal collapsed from superimposed Darius the First and Darius the Third, right? Darius the First after Koresh, then Achashverosh, then Dayavesh. And then Dayavish falls to Persia, falls to Greece. So clearly there's a problem here in terms of both the parshanut of it and the historical data that we have at our fingertips. And so once we start looking at that, now suddenly we realize that we need to do something. So, for example, the Ibn Ezra, again, we're going to sort all this out next week. But the Ibn Ezra records, he says, Rabbi Moshe HaKohen HaSfaradi Amar, Tishisha Malachim Ayu. They were, in fact, says the Ibn Ezra, wait a second, this doesn't fit. We know from other sources that there were, in fact, 6 Persian kings, not 4 or 3. And one of them was Dayavish HaZaken, who was Madi, right? First is Dayavish the Elder. And the second is Koresh, a Parsi. And then there's Achashverosh. And then there's Artaxerxes, who is Dayavish, should be commanded to build the city. Then there's Artaxerxes commanded to build the city. Then there's Dayavish commanded to build the temple. And then there is Artaxerxes the wealthy in Nehemiah's time. And he was the one who was killed by Alexander, says the Ibn Ezra. Well, that doesn't fit historically either, but you understand that suddenly we're not dealing with 4 kings. Now suddenly we've expanded to 6 kings. And we're beginning to expand the time frame here. Can't put that into 54 years. In addition, the dating changes. I'm sure you've heard the story of the missing 165 years of Jewish history, right? That missing 165 years of Jewish history is centered around exactly this issue of the dates of these Persian kings. So, in conclusion, and I will stop here. In conclusion, we have essentially a mess. In conclusion, we have 4 kings mentioned in Tanakh, maybe 5 if you include Artaxerxes, was mentioned in Sefer Nehemiah. Sorting out the chronology of the beginning of the Second Temple is a major headache. And why Chazal squeezed it all into 34 years or 54 years is a mystery. We know that, so we have a textual issue to deal with, Parshanut, and we have a historical issue to deal with. And it all revolves around identification of this king between Koresh and Dayavish called Achashverosh. And so I will, for now, have to leave this as a open question. But we will try to sort out much of it next week, because we have to come to some kind of resolution. And I will share with you three or four different approaches to why the chronology got so distorted, and then share with you what I think is the easiest way to navigate through this historical time frame, one that will work in terms of text, but it's going to force us to rethink everything we know about Megillat Esther. So if you thought you knew the story of the Megillat Esther, you're going to have to come back next week, because we're going to relearn the story of Achashverosh and Megillat Esther from the ground up. So that's next week. Have fun.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Rabbi, can I ask you a question?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We learn in Achashverosh that the reason he didn't rescind, at least the common thing, that he didn't rescind the decree against the Jews because he wasn't allowed to, so therefore he promulgated a decree that they could defend themselves. So how is Darius allowed to rescind his decree about allowing the Jews to rebuild the temple?
So if you go through, you're correct. It's actually very, very core to the culture of both Babylon and Persia. And we saw this early with Daniel and in the story of the Lion's Den. But once these kings wrote a decree, once it was written and promulgated, they couldn't just change their mind. Communication was very different. Once you put it out there, you couldn't just change your mind. Once it's been sealed and signed, it says so about Achashverosh, it says so about Nebuchadnezzar. If you look at the story, what you'll see, I would encourage you to read through on that website, alatorah.org. You can read through Hebrew and English. Read through the chapter of Ezra chapter 4, because what he basically says is that Darius went looking for the original decree that Cyrus had signed, meaning any decree from Cyrus's records. And what it says there is he found the first letter allowing the Jews to build the temple. He did not find the second letter. So it's kind of this sort of like Achashverosh, who can't sleep, and he opens up his Book of Chronicles and it happens to hit the story of Mordechai. And Darius goes looking for what did Cyrus actually do, and historically, and he found the earlier letter, but he didn't find record of the second letter. So it's all he had to work with was the original. So he said, okay, then they can build. So that's how it comes about.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful week. And we'll see you all, Bezat Hashem, next week.
Shabbat Shalom.